What is leaven or yeast? It is a small but necessary ingredient to make bread rise. Like Paul says in Galatians 5:9, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. According to the dictionary, leaven or yeast is a unicellular fungi of the genus Caceromyces, especially Caceromyces cerevisiae, reproducing by budding and from ascospores and capable of fermenting carbohydrates. Now that was a spiritually uplifting experience, wasn't it? You had no idea that you came to this service tonight to cogitate on unicellular profundities so that you could postulate on culinary extrapolations. Now you know how to do it. But seriously, leaven is a living organism. And Jesus used leaven to illustrate the growth of his kingdom. Because it will start out small, but will spread through the entire earth. Jesus also used leaven to illustrate evil. Evil is a living organism introduced into a person's heart. And then it so grows that it takes over the whole person. We'll be seeing that tonight in Mark chapter 8. Also in Mark chapter 8, we will watch a blind man heal. But he sees men like walking trees. And then Jesus does another miracle, and everything is okay with the man. Let's start off by looking at Mark 8. Verses 1 through 10. Here it is written, "In those days the multitude, being great and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said to them, 'I have compassion on the multitude, because they have now been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their own houses, they will faint on the way, for some of them have come from afar.' Then his disciples answered him, 'How can one satisfy these people with bread here in the wilderness?' He asked them, 'How many loaves do you have?' And they said, 7. And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves and gave thanks, broke them, and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And they set them before the multitude. And they had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said to set them also before them. So they ate and were filled, and they took up 7 large baskets of leftover fragments. Now those who had eaten were about 4,000. And he sent them away. And immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and came to the region of Dalmanutha." Excuse me again, that projector's light, even on the no show, is very bright. Okay, that's a little better. All right. Jesus has compassion on the multitude, showing them, do not worry about the necessities of life. If we are seeking His things, which are the higher spiritual things in life, He will make sure that we have the lower material things in life. Supplying us with food and clothing is a small matter. In fact, He even does it for people who do not care for Him. But if we do care for Him and His things, do we not think that He will have compassion on us as we learn from Him and toil in His kingdom? It is getting us to see spiritual truths and living them that is the more trying thing for Him. He doesn't have to persuade us to eat and be clothed, because we have a tendency to go overboard in those areas. What do we see in the Gospel according to Mark? What we see is the Lord, as I point out this morning, and I have another messages as well. He's trying to get us to see the spiritual things of life and to focus on those things. Now, coming back here to Mark 8, the disciples cannot see how feeding this large group of people is possible in a wilderness. He feeds billions daily, or perhaps millions then, daily through nature, is feeding 4,000 or 5,000 miraculously that difficult for him? Not at all. Did he not create all things from the power of his spoken word? Did he not create the process that gives us bread in the first place? Has he not already fed 5,000 miraculously? Has he not already healed the blind and the deaf, walked on water, and raised the dead in the first 7 chapters of Mark? Did not God satisfy Israel with bread in the wilderness when they numbered more than 4,000, more like closer to 4 million? And yet they're wondering how he's going to feed these people in this situation. As with feeding the 5,000, the Lord asked the disciples how much they have. How much do you have? Of course, he's speaking about how much bread they have. Jesus then proceeds to feed the crowd. Watch what he does. He makes them sit down, gives thanks, breaks the loaves, has the disciples pass out the bread, and then the same thing with the fish. Again, the multitude is filled, leftovers are taken up, and this time 7 large baskets of leftovers are taken up. And these are not crumbs, but leftovers. In other words, something you can eat at another meal. The Lord opens the windows of heaven and pours out a blessing that they don't have room enough to contain it. Their cup is running over. Do you not see what he's able to do? He is again trying to get them to see that point. The problem is not whether the Lord is able to provide for us, but whether we believe that he can do it. Now, verses 11 through 13. Why do people seek a sign? Mark writes this. And the Pharisees came out and began to dispute with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven, testing him. But he sighed deeply in his heart and said, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Assuredly, I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation." And he left them, and getting into the boat again, departed to the other side. The Pharisees show up disputing with Jesus. Puny men. Disputing with the Lord of Lords. And they want to see a sign from him that he is indeed from heaven. Well, why was not the healing of the paralytic back in chapter 2 that they witnessed not enough? Why was the restoration of a man's withered hand in chapter 3 that they witnessed not enough? That's why Jesus responds the way he does here. All the miracles that he has done so far are not enough because their motive was not to believe, but to test him. Listen to his response. He sighs deeply in his spirit. He grows impatient and frustrated because they are seeking the wrong thing. And he wonders out loud why that generation is seeking a sign. Therefore, they're not going to get any more signs. Now, having gone through that incident, he's now with his disciples, and look at the conversation he has with them now in verses 14 and 21. Now, the disciples had forgotten to take bread, and they did not have more than one loaf with them in the boat. Then he charged them, saying, take heed. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. So they reasoned among themselves, saying, it is because we have no bread. And Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, why do you reason because you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive nor understand? Is your heart still hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments did you take up? They said to him, 12. And when I broke the 7 for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of fragments did you take up? And they said, 7. So he said to them, how is it you do not understand? Well, again, we're presented in a situation here, Mark, where they lack bread. And again, the Lord directs his disciples into spiritual thinking. But they think that he speaks of literal bread. They can only think in terms of this world. But listen to the Lord as he listen carefully as he responds to them. He wonders why they reason about having no bread. He feeds millions daily. They saw him feed 5,000 in a desert. They just saw him feed 4,000 in a wilderness. However, it's too much for him to feed 12 in a boat on a lake. Now, he can't handle that. They don't understand. He marvels at their lack of understanding, and in so doing, in the text here, he reveals the problem, at least three things, as to why they were having a difficult time understanding. Number one, he shows that it comes from a hard heart. Your hearts are hard. And what was so hard about their hearts? Well, they were refusing to put away material thinking and refusing to believe in the Lord. Secondly, it comes from not seeing with our eyes and hearing with our ears. That is, truly thinking about our surroundings and truly thinking on what the Lord teaches in His Word. See, they just saw the material things and stopped right there. They didn't then reason, how does He take care of me in the Spirit? And will He take care of me in the Spirit? And thirdly, he points out that it comes from not remembering. Not remembering that He supplies us with all our needs and that He promises to continue to do so. Then he reminds them of the two incidences when he fed people miraculously. They should now understand, but they do not. Now let's look at verses 22 through 26, where we have this incident where a man describes men like walking trees. Then he came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. So they took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. And when he had spit on his eyes and put his hands on him, he asked him if he saw anything. And he looked up and said, I see men like trees walking. Then he put his hands on his eyes again and made him look up. And he was restored and saw everyone clearly. And he sent him away to his house, saying, neither go into the town nor tell anyone in the town. They begged Jesus to heal a blind man. But again, you can see his reluctance. Especially because he does not want this to spread. Now observe the healing and its two stages. Jesus spits on the man's eyes and puts his hands on the man's on the man. Why does the Lord then ask him if he sees anything? Jesus has not done this before. We did not see him ask the deaf when he healed them, "Do you hear anything?" or "What do you hear?" And the man responds that he sees men walking. They look like walking trees. But then again, Jesus puts his hands on the man's eyes, makes him look up, and he sees everything properly. What is going on here? Why did he have to do it in a second stage? Was Jesus not able to heal the man the first time? And he kind of had to give it a second shot here to get things done properly? Let me give to you three things here to think about. First is this. What we see going on here is still a miracle. It is still a miracle that is happening. Jesus bypasses the laws of nature using no medicine. There's no surgery such as a cornea transplant. Secondly, Jesus heals in the manner that he wants to do, not the way men tell him to do it. Back in chapter 7, verse 32, the people begged Jesus to heal someone by touching that person. Here again, they beg for a healing by having the Lord touch that person. Touch him, here's the way we want you to do it, and it'll be done. But the Lord shows it is not by his mere touch. It's not as though there's some magic. It's not as though there's some formula or a ritual that you have to go through. He is the power. And he will choose the method. You know, he could touch, he could spit, he could speak, he could do anything he wants. He doesn't even have to be present, as we noticed this morning. He healed from another place. You see, sometimes we get like Naaman. Remember old Naaman back in the Old Testament? He had his own ideas on how God would get rid of his leprosy. And as long as he continued to operate on his own ideas, he retained his leprosy. And when he finally submitted to God's ways, then he was healed. Therefore, in Mark 7, 32 and 33, the Lord did not do it in the way that the people told him to do it. But he put his fingers in the man's ears, spit, and then touched the man's tongue. Likewise, here in chapter 8, verses 22 to 26. Again, the people tell Jesus, touch the man. But Jesus does it a little bit differently than what they've told him to do, showing that he will heal the way he does, and the power is under his control. It's not some magical spell. Thirdly, Jesus shows the genuineness of the miracle 1900 years before we even truly know what is going on. You see, anyone could write a story of a miracle worker, but to plant scientific or human growth or medical information into the text before it is understood shows that a true miracle took place. For example, or let me illustrate what I'm talking about. There is a movie called At First Sight, which is based on a true story of a 50-year-old man whose sight was restored surgically after he lost it early in life. Regaining his sight was not a joyful experience because he did not understand what he saw. When the doctor held a can of Coke before the man, he did not know what it was. Like how Jesus did here, the doctor asked him to look at the can of Coke, like Jesus asking the man, you know, what do you see? And the man did not know that it was a can of Coke until he touched it with his hands. That's how he was used to functioning. Well, that man and this man in Mark chapter 8 were no longer blind perceptually, but they were still blind conceptually. The man in Mark 8 can see at first, but he cannot make sense of what he sees. Then in the second stage of the miracle, Jesus gives the man's brain the instant ability to recognize what he saw, something that takes us, you know, a lifetime to develop, you know, starting from our very youngest ages. And then sometime last year, I was watching, I think it was Good Morning America, and they had a man on there who experienced the same thing as the man I was just talking about in the movie, and who experienced what this man did here in Mark chapter 8. And they gave a website, and I went to the website and just gathered up tons of information, and I want to give you just a little bit of it tonight. I got some things to read to you, so let's just take a second here. After 43 years of blindness, Michael May can see again. But May can't recognize his sons, Carson 11 and Winham 9, by their faces alone. The same goes for identifying Jennifer, his wife of 15 years. 3 years after surgery restored sight to May's right eye, researchers say May's case shows how vision is more than just eye function. Blindness has long-term effects on how the brain processes information and constructs one's view of the world. May lost his sight to a chemical explosion when he was 3.5 years old. He eventually lost his left eye and remained blind in his right until a surgery in 2000. But testing since that surgery has shown that May's ability to interpret what he sees through his good eye is decidedly mixed. May can identify simple shapes and colors. He can interpret objects in motion. He can spy faraway peaks. He marvels at the vibrancy of plants and flowers unseen since he has lost his vision. But three-dimensional perception and the ability to recognize complex objects such as the faces of family and friends remain severely impaired. He strains to tell the difference between a man and a woman. He describes a cube as a square with extra lines. There has always been this question, what would happen if a blind man got his vision back? Is it something innate, or is it something we learn from first principles? Fine, Binet asked, that's one of the researchers. Is it something that happens, or is it something that we learn like language? Repeatedly, the researchers combined vision tests with scans of May's brain activity to study how blindness had affected him. When asked to identify a cube illustrated on a two-dimensional computer screen, for example, May failed. But once Fine commanded the cube to rotate, simulating motion in three dimensions, he immediately recognized it. Now, to me, that was fascinating to see that particular bit of information, and immediately to see why I think of Mark chapter 8. Jesus here was providing Mark this information to show us that this is not fake. This is real. This was a genuine miracle before we even would understand scientifically that it's not just seeing, but there's things that go on in the brain along with seeing. So Jesus does the miracle in two stages, not because he was a failure the first time, but he's showing us that as the Creator, he understands these things. And it took us centuries later before we finally discovered what is going on here. Now I think, back in verse 18, the disciples have the same problem as this man in the first stage of the miracle. But in a spiritual sense, And so did the general population back in chapter 4, verse 12. And so does the world today. That is, how many people see what is in Scripture, they can open up the Bible and read it, but it does not make a connection in the heart. And that's, of course, where the church comes in. We're to educate people and bring them up to speed on what it is that they're seeing in the Bible. All right, let's look at verses 27 through 30. Now, Jesus and his disciples went out to the towns of Caesarea Philippi. And on the road, he asked his disciples, saying to them, "Who do men say that I am?" And they answered, "John the Baptist, some say Elijah, and others one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered and said to him, "You are Christ." Then he charged them that they should tell no one about him. Well, who do men say that Jesus is? Well, you can see what the response was. Some say you're John the Baptist. Some say you're Elijah. Some say you're one of the prophets. And people today still have various opinions as to who Jesus is. Some say, like Judaism, that he's just a great teacher. Islam says he's a mighty prophet. The Watchtower Society says that he's a created angel, specifically Michael, the archangel. Mormonism says he is a man who became a god. The Moonies say he's another Messiah, just like Moses or someone else. Theological liberals say that he's another wise man. But then Jesus brings the question home, pierces their own hearts, and says, "Now who do you say that I am?" Peter gives a brilliant answer. Jesus is the Christ. Now, if you agree with Peter, think on what Jesus then teaches next. Are we minding the things of God or the things of men? He then commands them to remain silent about his identity because the time of his crucifixion is coming rapidly. And to be going around proclaiming that he's the Christ will only hasten his death. It's not time for that. So, now let's look at verses 31 to 33. And think about what are we minding, things of God or men. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He spoke this word openly. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when he had turned around and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but of the things of men." Things are going so well. Now he teaches that things are going to change dramatically. He will suffer many things, be rejected by the leaders, and he will be killed. But 3 days later, he will rise again. Peter didn't hear that part. It should have alerted Peter to the fact that Jesus willingly submitted to the suffering and the killing, and that death will not stop him, and that he will rise again. They'll see him again. But again, Peter doesn't hear the last part. The Lord turns, looks at all the disciples, but then directs his attention to Peter and says, "Get behind me, Satan." One moment, the Father influences Peter to confess that Jesus is the Christ. Seconds later, Peter is following Satan. Peter is minding the things of men and not the things of God. What are the things of God? Well, we saw earlier in Mark 8 that God is concerned with matters of the Spirit. He wants to save us from sin and not necessarily from the dangers of the world, which are only temporary. But the dangers of sin last forever. Having said that, now watch what Jesus says in the rest of the chapter, Mark 8, 34 through 38. "And when he had called the people to him, with his disciples also, he said to them, 'Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow him. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what will it profit him if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? For what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him the Son of Man also will be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. But here in this particular teaching context, Jesus states that there are three conditions to following him. Deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow Jesus. This is living a life willing to suffer for him now. If we suffer for him now, we will not suffer later. If we avoid suffering for him now, we will suffer later. If we gain everything but lose our souls, Jesus says, what have we gained? What is more valuable to us than our souls? Not even the whole world. So let us not be ashamed of Jesus and his words. He says this generation is adulterous and sinful. And because of that, there is the temptation to be ashamed or to be embarrassed by our belief in Jesus and in his words. And if we are ashamed of Jesus, he will be ashamed of us when he returns in the glory of his Father and of the holy angels. The only way, I think, is what he's showing here in this text. To overcome this temptation is to believe with all your heart that Jesus is the Christ. Then deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow the Lord. And that all begins with repentance and baptism. If you have been ashamed of him, and if you've done something to bring shame on his name, and you want us to pray for you, please come forward right now as we stand and sing.